Japan's ongoing nuclear cover-up. There have been lots of news stories coming out of Japan about how the Fukushima nuclear triple meltdown disaster has already been handled, and it's cleaned up enough for people to move back into the area, for crops to be grown there, and sake to be brewed and exported, and children to be brought up in areas previously marked as evacuation zones and difficult-to-return zones. Those in power are doing their best to convince the world, and especially the people of Japan, that there's nothing to be worried about, just move on back in. There's a housing incentive, splashy new schools, new museums. Isn't it wonderful? But then you hear from a genuine expert, an experienced journalist with a history of publishing at the highest levels with deeply researched work, and he tells you,
it's a disaster. It's not an accident. And it's even worse than that because it's a scandal, because it's ongoing. The reactors are still in the process of melting down. They still are highly radioactive and deadly. The Japanese have failed to contain the disaster. And as a sign of their having failed to contain the disaster, they are now dumping huge quantities of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean.
And so much more. Well, when author and journalist Thomas Bass shines a light on the truth of Fukushima 14 years after the disaster not happened, but began and is still ongoing, you get to see how persistent and unending is that terrible, awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Thomas Bass. He is author of the just-published book, Return to Fukushima. He peels away layers of sugar-coated lies that Japan, TEPCO, and the nuclear industry have been spewing about the triple meltdown disaster and its aftermath, and presents the truth of what happened, why, and what it's like for people attempting to rebuild their lives in areas that until recently were classified as too radioactive to even visit. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than Vladimir Zelensky revealed before this week's devastating attack on Russian nuclear warplanes. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the United States, Linda Pence Gunter has been covering the numerous executive orders and actions emanating from the White House. Here, she explains in her inimitable style why the Golden Dome is another insane Trump obsession that will not work.
Last week, we reported on the White House executive orders that would lay waste to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and put an end to any meaningful safety oversight of the U.S. commercial nuclear sector. Not that there was a whole lot to begin with. None of us will be standing outside the agency's Rockville, Maryland headquarters anytime soon holding Save the NRC signs. I mentioned last week that there were 5 orders affecting the nuclear sector. Technically, the 5th, Restoring Gold Standard Science, didn't mention nuclear, but its overarching mission, to do the opposite of what its title says, will most certainly negatively affect the integrity of any evaluation of new reactor designs, with a stamp of approval given to the Department of Energy and even the Department of Defense rather than the NRC. You may have noticed that the gold standard science order reflected Trump's obsession with a small collection of words, gold being one of his absolute most favorite ones, along with big, beautiful, dominance, and unleashing. All right, as it turns out, the golden toilet was just a myth. Donald Trump doesn't have one. But not to fret, President Trump's private Boeing 757 jet, not the even more lavish one he may shortly be gifted by Qatar, reportedly has gold-plated seatbelts. His Trump Tower apartment features a 24-carat gold front door. Inside there are gold ceilings, golden plant pots, and even a gold elevator. Trump's favorite restaurant is, of course, the Golden Arches, also known as McDonald's. And then there's his lustrous golden tan with the reverse raccoon eyes. And of course, we were reminded, both at Trump's inaugural and during his joint address to Congress 6 weeks later, that we are about to enter the golden age. It will be like nothing that has ever been seen before. This is one of the few true things Trump has ever said. There are a few other gilded examples I could offer up, except they're not really suitable for family programming, but you can find them in my article on Counterpunch. Meanwhile, as Trump is due to parade his military hardware through the streets and skies of DC on June 14th, at a cost of $45 million to US taxpayers, we are told there is too much wasteful spending, so Medicaid, Medicare, and food stamps must be slashed. As if all this golden fleecing of American taxpayers wasn't enough, cue the next fanfare, but without any actual golden trumpeters, the Golden Dome for America. Golden Dome for America is a revolutionary concept to further the goals of peace through strength, asserts its manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, our first clue that the Golden Dome has nothing whatever to do with peace, as Lockheed Martin is a major player in the US nuclear weapons complex. The Golden Dome is effectively a reboot of Ronald Reagan's ill-fated Strategic Defense Initiative, mockingly nicknamed Star Wars, which was supposed to shoot down incoming nuclear missiles. That was just the latest failed iteration of a US missile defense concept that has been in the works since the 1950s. Reagan's SDI arguably cost us a chance to rid the world of nuclear weapons altogether when in 1986 he and then Russian Premier Mikhail Gorbachev were poised to do just that. Gorbachev wanted Star Wars consigned to the laboratory. Reagan refused. The arms race continued. Trump brags he has already picked out the architecture he likes for his Golden Dome, which makes you wonder whether he thinks it's some sort of floating palace, a Mar-a-Lago in the sky. When a poster of it was unveiled in the Oval Office, there was Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth doing his best Vanna White imitation. The price tag for the Golden Dome is a whopping $175 billion. There's austerity for you. And apparently it will all be up and running before Trump's term is out in January 2029. Assuming Trump willingly leaves office and we still have a democratic election process by then. It's a goal longtime national security and nuclear policy expert Joe Cirincione called insane in an interview with the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. You probably won't even get the architecture of the system settled by the end of his administration, Cirincione said. Even more insane is that, far from enhancing the safety of the US, the Golden Dome is entirely provocative and, as a nervous China has already warned, will only increase the risks of militarizing space and could even relaunch a global arms race, arguably something that is already underway. In any case, there's not much use in a Golden Dome unless it's 100% effective, which, like all its predecessors, it has a 100% probability of not being. The Golden Dome, it turns out, is no golden ticket to survival. But no matter, since, its proponents argue, the Golden Dome is merely a deterrent meant to frighten off aggressors. That means we are about to spend $175 billion on something the US would never actually use. Trump would do well to take a lesson from Shakespeare's Prince of Morocco, who, in The Merchant of Venice, discovers that all that glitters is not gold. Indeed, when he chooses the golden box, of course, over the other less sparkly ones, he learns that what tends to lurk inside such gilded tombs are merely worms. Or maybe Trump should just stop talking and heed the most important lesson of all. Silence is golden. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
We'll have links up to two stories that Linda Pence-Gunter has published in the last week. The first, Donald Trump's Fool's Gold from Counterpunch, and A Superhighway to Nuclear Hell, which comes from Beyond Nuclear International. They'll be linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 727. We'll also have links up to two additional articles, one by Edwin S. Lyman, who is Director of Nuclear Power Safety for the Union of Concerned Scientists, entitled The NRC's New Mission Impossible, Making Atoms Great Again, requiring the NRC to facilitate nuclear power by prioritizing speedy licensing over protecting public health and safety from radiation exposure, and an extensive analysis of nuclear weapon woes, understaffed nuke agency hit by DOGE, and safety worries. It runs down the consequences of DOGE's disruptions at the National Nuclear Security Administration and warned that they may be far-reaching. Over to Japan, where the International Atomic Energy Agency has reaffirmed Japan's safe discharge of the ALPS-treated water from Fukushima. This is a story that is completely contradicted by our interview today with Thomas Bass, who brings up many flaws in the IAEA's interpretation of the recent findings. In Ukraine, Greenpeace remote sensing satellite analysis has identified Russian engineering construction of an electricity high-voltage power line for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. This provides further confirmation of plans by the Russian state nuclear corporation, Rosatom, to restart the nuclear reactors at Zaporizhzhia. According to Sean Burney, nuclear specialist at Greenpeace Ukraine, this is some of the first hard evidence of Russia moving ahead with its dangerous and illegal plans for restarting Ukraine and Europe's largest nuclear plant at Zaporizhzhia. But the plant is the sole property of Ukraine, and this further step towards a potentially disastrous operation of the nuclear reactors must be condemned. The Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant must be deoccupied and returned to Ukraine. We'll link to that article as well. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, a week and a half from now, we'll mark the start of the 15th year of Nuclear Hot Seat. Who'd have thunk it? When I awkwardly cobbled together a conference call that I labeled a podcast on June 14, 2011, I had no idea that all this time later, I would still be presenting a weekly roundup of nuclear news from that all-important different perspective. It's been the journey of a lifetime, getting to know the issues, our history, locations of problems and disasters, the ongoing dangers, official manipulations and languaging lies, and most importantly, getting to know the brave, committed, heart-centered people in our community who are dedicated fighters against nukes. That would be you. Along the way, I've regularly beat out mainstream media on nuclear stories, gotten my stories ripped off by lazy reporters, and acknowledged by the good ones who cited the show as a source, traveled to locations to bring you stories of events and anniversaries, and tried my best to keep up with the multi-million dollar PR juggernaut that is nuclear. At times, it felt like all I was doing was narrating the rearrangement of the deck chairs on the Titanic. But at others, I knew, and I knew from your feedback as well, that the information I was able to provide helped focus important attention on activists, groups, and issues that might otherwise be ignored. Above all, I have sought to keep our movement in good heart. So in honor of the start of our 15th year, now would be a perfect time for you to honor the work with a donation. How about $15 for the 15th year? Symbolic. As a one-time donation or ongoing, either way, any amount, all will be gratefully appreciated. We run exclusively on donations, and without your support, we won't be able to continue. So let's keep this going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or set up an ongoing donation. You can also send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. So in honor of the start of our 15th year and beyond, do what you can to support us and know that I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Thomas Bass is the author of 8 books, a contributor to The New Yorker, The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, Smithsonian, Wired, and other publications. He's also a professor of English and journalism at the State University of New York in Albany. In 2018, and again 4.5 years later, he traveled to Fukushima. The difference between those two experiences was dramatic. The area around the nuclear disaster has been somewhat cleaned up and reopened. Some people had returned, but the problems are far from over. His latest book, Return to Fukushima, offers a clear-eyed, concise look at what it's like to try to live in the wake of an atomic disaster. I spoke with Thomas Bass on June 2nd, 2025. Thomas Bass, it is a delight to have you on Nuclear Hot Seat today.
Well, Libby, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background and how did you become involved in covering nuclear issues?
Well, in this book of mine that I just published, Return to Fukushima, I describe a bit of my family history. My father's involvement in making atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs. So that sort of has been in the family for a long time. I'm also a writer, a science writer, or I write on scientific subjects. I write on many subjects, but atomic energy, nuclear power plants, and industrial disasters are important subjects. To cut right to the chase, Fukushima, I believe, is the world's worst industrial accident. It's a disaster. It's not an accident. Excuse me, I misspoke. And it's even worse than that because it's a scandal, because it's ongoing. The reactors are still in the process of melting down. They still are highly radioactive and deadly. The Japanese have failed to contain the disaster. And as a sign of their having failed to contain the disaster, they are now dumping huge quantities of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. And it's been an utter failure, an utter disaster, and also something that's been a tragedy and catastrophic for tens of thousands of people, not just in Japan, but also now in the rest of the world as this radioactive water is dumped into the ocean.
It's been 14 years since the Fukushima disaster began. What do you find that people most misunderstand about what's still going on there?
The disaster is still ongoing. There's a nuclear disaster about every 10 years when you add them all up. Three Mile Island, the disaster that shaped your life and you're familiar with, that could be dismissed as operator error, was how that one was excused. And then, of course, came Chernobyl. That could be dismissed as defective Russian technology. And those Russians, of course, they don't know how to manage their nuclear reactors. Fukushima, on the other hand, it's a first world country, first world reactors built by General Electric. These were GE Mark I containment nuclear power plants. And they blew up. They exploded. And three of them melted down and are still in the process of melting down. And the Japanese government has tried to cover up the fact that the disaster is still ongoing. They're really, through sleight of hand and propaganda and all sorts of other measures, trying to pretend that the disaster is in hand, under control, when in fact it is not under control.
What are some of the most prevalent lies or distortions of information, disinformation, that are being put forth by the Japanese government, by Tokyo Electric Power Company, and the nuclear industry to make it sound like things are under control at Fukushima?
I have a long list here in front of me. But let me just begin with the most obvious one. The first of many items to note is that the government wants us to pay attention to the fact that they are dumping huge amounts of tritium into the ocean. And of course, all nuclear reactors dump tritium into the bodies of water that are used to cool them. So there would be no nuclear power plants, there would be no nuclear industry if the dangers of tritium were actually revealed. So the nuclear industry would like you to believe that tritium is a relatively mild-mannered, perfectly harmless thing to be dumping into the ocean. Well, I don't want to dance on the head of a pin there because it's really irrelevant. What the Japanese are also dumping into the ocean is plutonium and strontium and cesium and iodine-131. There are 62 radionuclides that are in the cooling water at Fukushima that are being dumped into the ocean. And the Tokyo Electric Power Company, the agency that is pretending to be managing the disaster at Fukushima, has no idea what radionuclides are in the cooling water. They have failed to remove the radionuclides. They pretended to have cleaned up the water. They lied about it. Then they had to reveal the fact that they were lying about it. Then they had to reveal the fact that three quarters of the cooling water is still highly radioactive and highly contaminated and be currently being dumped into the ocean. So, in answer to your question, that's only item number one of the cover-up. There is a long list of factors involved in covering up the fact that the Fukushima disaster is ongoing.
Now, there has been a steady push, propaganda, incentives to bring people back to the Fukushima area to settle, to live there, to rebuild it. And a big deal is being made about the reclamation of the area. How are they accomplishing that? And what do you think is the advisability of people moving back into that area?
Well, first of all, that's a fair amount of sleight of hand and propaganda. Because if you were to take an airplane and then ride the very nice train up to Fukushima, you would find ghost towns that are currently uninhabited and where you have animals who've moved into people's houses. The towns immediately next to the Fukushima reactors are, as they say, ghost towns. They're still highly radioactive. We'll talk about this a bit later. There's been a huge project, an astounding project to scrape all the topsoil off of the land around the nuclear reactors and lower the levels of radiation by scraping off the topsoil and dumping sand onto the land, thereby destroying whatever rice growing and productive capability Fukushima used to have. But I want to mention one point first of all. The management of So-called management of the disaster began, first of all, by raising the dose rates, the tolerable dose rates for radioactive exposure. The dose rates around the world, and you'll have to excuse me when I mention sieverts and becquerels, there's no way to avoid it. These are units of measurement. They're named after the scientists who first identified them. I will do my best to explain what they mean, but very simply, the global standard is 1 millisievert per year is the recommended dose rate for radiation above the radiation that we normally receive. What the Japanese did immediately after the Fukushima disaster was to raise the dose rate to 20 millisieverts per year, from 1 to 20. Now, 20 is the dose rate that's usually reserved for workers in nuclear power plants. They can receive a larger dose rate because they're being paid to expose themselves to radiation. Anyway, a dose rate of 20 millisieverts per year for women and children is incredibly dangerous. And that is what the Japanese are now considering a tolerable dose rate for moving people back into Fukushima, when in fact it is not the case. As I say, the government, through sleight of hand, is pretending that they have managed to remediate the area and make it capable of being resettled, when in fact that's absolutely untrue. 75% of the area is forested. Those forests are huge reservoirs for radionuclides. Every time it rains, the radionuclides flood down into the coastal areas, which are recontaminated. And anyone who walks around Fukushima with a any kind of Geiger counter or a device for measuring radioactivity, will discover hotspots. You'll discover areas that are highly radioactive. Whenever I would walk around Fukushima with knowledgeable people, for instance, we would go to schoolyards, and the schoolyards would have been scraped of topsoil, and they would be considered safe for school children to play in the schoolyard. Well, as soon as you step 1 foot off of the schoolyard into the surrounding vegetation, you'll find a spike, very large spikes of radioactivity. And as I say, the reactors themselves, the nuclear reactors at Fukushima, are still astoundingly radioactive. They have rates as high as 10,000 millisieverts per hour. Now, you remember I was talking about 20 millisieverts per year is the dose rate for people. The reactors themselves are 10,000 millisieverts per hour, which is why when you take a look at the reactors, you're only allowed to stand there for a few minutes on a viewing platform, because otherwise you'd be in danger of irradiating yourself. But anyway, the reactors are still so radioactive that the robots and devices that are sent inside the reactors to take a look at the damage that has occurred, they're fried, they're burned up, they're destroyed in rapid order. And this has happened now for the past 14 years, which is why I will mention, as part of the ongoing disaster at Fukushima, we do not even know where the radioactive fuel is located. The reactors are still in the process of melting down. The Japanese pretend that they, in the next 30 years, they will be able to clean up the damage. First step in cleaning up the damage would be to locate where is the radioactive fuel? Where did it go? Did it explode all over the insides of these reactors? Did it fall through the floor of the reactors? Is it in some big lump in elephant's foot? Or is it completely scattered all over the place? And we, at the moment, have not the slightest idea where it's located.
That, of course, is devastating. And yet there's even more. What are some of the other dangers or difficulties or things that people have perhaps lost track of or not been thinking about in terms of Fukushima that they really need to know?
In my book, I struggled over this a great deal and spent a lot of time talking to people about it. The Japanese government has poured a tremendous amount of money into the area, rebuilding town halls, rebuilding train stations, schools, trying to lure people into the region, actually providing subsidies. And they have actually built four new museums there. One can go from museum to museum in Fukushima, even though the area, as I say, is depopulated. But something that I struggled with, Libby, is the government pretends, let me begin with a fact. In 2017, the Japanese government stopped paying subsidies to nuclear refugees. Now, let's get the numbers here. When the great tsunami struck Fukushima 14 years ago, there were about 400,000 people who fled the coast. There were about 20,000 people who were killed. It was an astounding, devastating phenomenon to have that huge wave wash over the eastern side of Honshu Island. Among those 400,000 people who fled the region are what are considered 160,000 people who were fleeing the meltdown of three nuclear reactors. And there was an astoundingly high level of radiation. As I say, the reactors still today, if you get close to them, are giving out 10,000 millisieverts per hour. That will kill you. The area had to be evacuated for fear that the reactors, three of them did blow up, three of them exploded. But the disaster could have been even worse than it was. The Tokyo Electric Power Company planned to abandon Fukushima. They plan to let the site simply fall into the ocean and remain a radioactive hotspot in perpetuity. The Japanese government effectively seized the company, seized the Tokyo Electric Power Company, and forced them to continue pumping cooling water into the reactors. So anyway, there were about 160,000 people who were evacuated from a 20-kilometer area around the reactors. Now, the Japanese government pretends that out of that 160,000 people, there are only about 25,000 who remain as nuclear refugees. Well, that's simply untrue. That's simply a sleight of hand. people have resettled in other parts of Japan. They've moved in with family members elsewhere in the country. They've moved into other parts of Fukushima, the area. But of the 160,000 people who fled the area, very few of them have actually been able to return to their houses. So I maintain that instead of 25,000 nuclear refugees, there are about 100,000 nuclear refugees from Fukushima. I imagine people are going to want to dispute me on that, but I'm willing to stand up and support that claim.
You traveled to Fukushima in 2018 and again in 2022. What changes did you find between those two trips?
The first time I visited Fukushima, the devastation was quite noticeable. That tsunami that had washed over the coast and destroyed the houses and the cities and the villages and the farmland had left behind just a wreck of coastline. But the Japanese are very tidy, well-organized people. For example, lining the coast on my first visit were these very large structures that were devoted to burning up the refuse. They were incinerators. So all of the old houses, the wrecks, the boats, the highways, the street signs, the shops were hauled off to the incinerators and burned up. And of course, that left a residue of highly radioactive material at the bottom of these incinerators. And then this was part of this astronomical project involving 100,000 people who would scrape up 5 centimeters of topsoil of all the territory around the nuclear power plant. And if you scrape up all the topsoil, you effectively reduce the level of radiation in the area that you've scraped up the topsoil. This presumes that more radionuclides are not carried back into that area from rainstorms. Anyway, this involved 100,000 people scraping up huge quantities of soil from Fukushima that were put in these black plastic sort of garbage bags. And on my first visit, those garbage bags were stacked up all over Fukushima. They looked kind of like, they didn't look like pyramids. They looked like mastabas, which are flat-topped pyramids. But they just massive amount of scraped up soil. On my second visit, this soil had been taken out of the black plastic garbage bags and had been put into a large depository, a huge dump built behind the nuclear power plant. When I use the word dump, this is a very technically advanced dump because the dump is devoted to separating out the metals, for example, from all of the refuse with some hope of somehow reusing those metals in construction in Japan, which is an absolutely crazy idea. And other things that are separated out are topsoil that is slightly less contaminated. And this topsoil is going to be used in construction projects in Japan. Only last week it was announced, this received a fair amount of news, that the Prime Minister's flower garden in Tokyo was going to be receiving a shipment of slightly less radioactive topsoil. Anyway, this is an example of the kind of propaganda and sleight of hand that is ongoing in Japan at the moment. And also my fellow journalists who are incredibly gullible. They're just suckers for whatever appears to be good news. And they will just print anything that's put out involving the good news involving nuclear power plants. Only last week, we received the good news that the Japanese prime minister is going to be planting his flower beds in Fukushima topsoil. And then if you scratch the surface, so to speak, if you dig slightly more deeply, you will discover that this topsoil was originally scheduled to be put into parks in Tokyo. And there was an uprising on the part of the citizens of Tokyo who refused to have this radioactive topsoil put into their parks. So the prime minister has now stepped forward to put it into his flower beds. But again, the way the Japanese work, this good news is reported by my fellow gullible journalists. But in fact, the Japanese prime minister is only studying the situation. He's only preparing to receive the radioactive soil into his flower beds. So I suspect that not even the prime minister will be getting radioactive soil from Fukushima. But if I may continue this anecdote a bit farther, this is all preparatory to using the soil from Fukushima to build roadways, embankments, railroad tracks, construction projects. In other words, Japan has this, what I consider a crazy idea, to irradiate the entire country. The radioactive topsoil from Fukushima that's been scattered all around Japan at the moment, supposedly is soil that has less than 8,000 becquerels per kilo. Now, 8,000 becquerels per kilo is still fairly radioactive. In fact, you wouldn't want to be scattering that around schoolyards, for example. This is all part of the process. You know, the Japanese government has maintained that all of the radioactive soil scraped up in Fukushima, all of the radioactive waste, all of the fuel rods from the nuclear power plant is to be removed from Fukushima. The Japanese government pretends, the Tokyo Electric Power Company pretends, that in 30 years, they will have managed the situation and removed all radioactivity from Fukushima. Well, first of all, in the meantime, the site is highly radioactive. It's leaking radioactivity into the ocean. The radioactive water is being dumped into the ocean. And Tokyo Electric Power Company has no idea how to clean up the Fukushima reactors. This whole idea that Japan was going to become a world leader in nuclear remediation, I mean, after they failed so abysmally at running nuclear power plants, they were going to take the fallback position that they would become world leaders in remediating nuclear disasters. Well, in fact, they have done an abysmal job at that and have failed one test after another. So that, as I say, the disaster is ongoing at this very moment.
Now, there are people living in the area. Some are those who evacuated, who came back. Some of them are younger people who have been attracted there by whatever the incentives are that the government has been offering. How are they managing in this radioactive environment to protect themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question. As anyone knows about nuclear disasters, it all depends which way the wind is blowing and whether it rains and where the radioactivity falls out. So that there's kind of a hopscotch phenomenon where, you know, one area can be relatively safe and another area can be not safe. Chernobyl, for example, there's the Red Forest, which is highly radioactive, in which the Russian invaders were stupid enough to try to bivouac in and dig trenches. And of course, irradiated themselves in the process. But anyway, I won't dwell on the stupidity of the Russian invaders of Ukraine. But anyway, in Chernobyl, they buried 70 villages. 70 villages in Chernobyl were considered so radioactive that they just dug holes in the ground and put the villages underground. Other parts of the area, you know, the wind wasn't blowing there and they're not quite as radioactive. And, you know, you can walk around and work in there for periods of time. And the same is true of Fukushima. For example, the town of Odaka, which is to the north of the nuclear power plant, the wind was not blowing in that direction. And people have been able to return to that town. And, you know, you want to scrub down your house. You want to remove as much contamination as possible. And it's also interesting, Libby, as you drive around on the highway, instead of, you know, those green road signs telling you that Howard Johnson's is up ahead or whatever, you have road signs giving you an indication of the radioactivity that's blowing up into the hills. So there are certain days when there's more radioactivity blowing around than on other days. Then, of course, as I describe in my book, I spent a lot of time walking around in the heels of people, experts who have vests loaded with radiation detectors and people who are knowledgeable about that. I spent a lot of time with someone who spent 30 years as a cleaner at the nuclear power plant, cleaning up radioactive spills. So there are people who are many more people than you would ever imagine have large radiation detectors and devices in their homes. There's even a woman who runs a little shop where every item that's for sale in the shop has its radiation levels indicated. And there's a great transfer of knowledge from Chernobyl to Fukushima, I might add. The people with whom I stayed during my two visits there have made a half dozen visits to Chernobyl because they wanted to learn how the people of Chernobyl have managed to survive in their nuclear exclusion zone. How do you do it? How do you survive? Well, you carry radiation detectors. You are extremely conscious of radiation. You eat certain kinds of foodstuffs and not other kinds of foodstuffs.
In the book, you describe visiting a lab where radiation and locally grown food is being measured by citizens. And you likened it to a daycare center full of radiation maps and equipment for monitoring a contaminated earth, which is a great image and unfortunately a very scary one. And then you ask, is this what our future looks like? Do you think this is what our future looks like?
Let me give you an example from that lab. There's a remarkably beautiful town called Iitate. It's up in the hills. It's about 50 miles away from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. But the wind was blowing in that direction and it rained, and the area got hit with a fair amount of radioactivity. So I was walking around there one day with somebody. We were foraging for mushrooms. There are 200 edible varieties of mushrooms in Japan. And the Japanese, in this particular town, people used to get as much as one half of their food from foraged food. So I get my hands on a mushroom there. It's a particularly treasured kind of mushroom. The Japanese love eating it. And the person warns me that it's very highly radioactive. Well, I took that mushroom to the laboratory that you just mentioned. A laboratory where we're filled with volunteers. People bring their children to work. The walls are covered with maps of where the fields are radioactive and where they're not radioactive. And we took a look at that mushroom. The Japanese are very strict about their limits on contamination in food. In fact, their limits are one-tenth as high as those in the United States. They allow only 100 becquerels per kilogram. In the United States, we allow 1,200 becquerels per kilogram. The levels in the United States, I do not believe, are safe. But if we lowered the levels in the United States, we would have less food to eat. So remember this fact, Libby, that the limits are 100 becquerels per kilogram. So we put this mushroom in a radiation detector, pull out the mushroom, and we get a reading of 88,000 becquerels per kilogram. So, in other words, that's thousands of times higher than is allowable. And that's one mushroom. And so, people who used to forage for their food, who used to pick wild plants and herbs and mushrooms and so on, can no longer do that. And this is true. This was 50 miles away from the nuclear power plant. And it's true in other parts of Japan as well. In this book of mine, maybe I exaggerate, maybe I don't exaggerate, who knows? I think that nuclear exclusion zones, there are a lot of them, and there are many more of them than people are aware of. And I think they're growing in size, and maybe they are melding one into another. Who the hell knows what's going to happen in Ukraine, for example, with all sorts of talk of nuclear atomic bombs being used? Or who knows what's going to happen with the next nuclear disaster, which, as I say, happens once every 10 years, in which we are overdue for.
You were over in Japan in the Fukushima area for an extended period of time. What did you do to protect yourself while you were over there?
I chuckle, I laugh about it. I mean, the first time I went, I stocked up on rice balls and water and planned to live on nothing but rice balls and my own water for weeks at a time. And of course, I found people who were cooking very good food and who were very, very conscious of how to keep their intake controlled and monitored. And, by the end, by the very end, I think I tell this story in the book, by the very end, my host is serving a wild mushroom that he says is, it's only slightly contaminated, he says, as he slices it up. And it's absolutely delicious mushroom. So you just adjust to what life presents, I think is how it works.
In the epilogue of your book, you entitle it The Cult of the Atom. Why did you refer to it as a cult?
Well, Libby, as you well know, we are surrounded by an astounding amount of propaganda involving nuclear power plants and supposedly small modular reactors and new reactor designs and all of the propaganda that is just washing over us at the moment for the latest nuclear renaissance. Oh my God, how many nuclear renaissances have we survived in our lives? Each one, of course, fails to deliver on what is promised. We haven't had a new nuclear power plant, well, other than the Vogtle plant, which cost, what is the latest sum, $36 billion or something, and 7 years behind schedule. And every ratepayer in Georgia is paying an extra $1,000 for that nuclear power plant. The splitting of the atom was considered such an astounding, almost quasi-religious event that we really have been worshiping the atom ever since it was first split. And we worshiped it, and it's unfortunate that the first application of atom splitting was to build bombs and kill large numbers of people. Atoms for war have really never separated themselves and become atoms for peace. You know, every nuclear power plant produces plutonium. Every nuclear power plant is capable of producing tritium and making bombs. That's how India got its bombs from civilian nuclear power plants. And that's how Pakistan got its bombs from civilian nuclear power plants. So there really is no distinction to be had here between civilian power plants and military power plants. And we're in the midst of a fever dream. It's just seized us by the collar, this mystical belief in the power of the atom to produce carbon-free energy, when of course it's not carbon-free, and of course it's energy that can kill us. We worship death in this instance. I don't know why we are so prone to belief in this propaganda. The Renaissance that is about to come around every corner has yet to arrive.
The book was just published officially last week. What, if any, response have you gotten to it, specifically through reviews or the comments of people who are prominent within our movement?
Over the, 14 years that your program has been broadcast?
I actually start my 15th year in 2 weeks.
Congratulations. And you have an unerring ability to pinpoint people who are knowledgeable and are able to talk about these matters in an intelligent fashion. So I don't want to run down the roster of people you've spoken to, but among those people, like you, who received early advanced copies of the book, generally been a great deal of enthusiasm. It's considered something essential and important, because who thinks about Fukushima at the moment? I mean, really, the Japanese government would like us stand clear, everybody. Nothing to see here as we dump radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean, where it will bioaccumulate and potentially cause a tremendous amount of damage. The green lighting of the dumping of that water into the Pacific Ocean was done in a remarkably ham-fisted and stupid fashion. The International Atomic Energy Agency and the Japanese government and all of the agencies that have signed off on that water release conducted some experiments that consisted of the following. They took some fish tanks and they put some of the treated, so-called treated water in the fish tanks, the cleanest water they could find, and they put some fish in the tanks, and they fed the fish with fish pellets, and the fish survived. And lo and behold, as Bob Richmond would say, he has high school students who could design a better experiment than that. Fish do not eat fish pellets. And putting fish in the cleanest water you can find is really not an experiment that's going to indicate bioaccumulation and the dangers of 62 radionuclides being dumped into the ocean. Anyway, Bob Richmond offered to help the Japanese government and the Tokyo Electric Power Company design better experiments, and they did not take him up on his offer. In response to the book, as you know, and as I've already mentioned, we are just bathed in propaganda on the need, the necessity, the wonders of building new nuclear power plants. I mean, the administration in its latest pronouncements imagines building 300 new nuclear power plants. That's not going to happen. And they imagine that new reactor designs are going to be powering the United States in very short order. That's not going to happen. None of it's going to happen. But in the meantime, hundreds of millions of dollars are being shoveled into this enterprise. Huge waste of resources, time, energy, when in fact we already know what's required to move into a carbon-free future. But anyway, those people who pay attention to these things, those people who are knowledgeable in these matters, are very glad to have a book reminding us that Fukushima is an ongoing disaster. So my fond hope, and your program, I'm counting on you, Libby, to do this for me, is to carry this book out from the realm of knowledgeable experts and smart and intelligent people, you among them, to the general public.
I will be delighted to do so because I found that the book was cleanly, clearly written. You did not go down into the rabbit hole of acronyms and technical information. You really made this something that I think a regular person who wants to know would be able to read and go, oh, I get it. It was that clearly articulated. And that's the way I'm framing it for my friends and also my listeners, because I think this is a cornerstone book, especially for those people who maybe know nothing about nuclear and want to know something, or who already know something about nuclear but would like to know a little bit more and learn about it in a clean, clear, efficient manner.
Thank you very much. So how many more copies of this book can I send you?
Is there yet, or will there be, are there plans for a Japanese edition of the book?
Yes. Several people have approached me about a Japanese edition of the book. That's a difficult question, and maybe you don't want to get into it, but you know, Japan ranks very low on the World Press Freedom Index. And Japan, there's a fair amount of censorship. There was a gag order placed on scientists after the Fukushima disaster. It took the government 6 weeks to admit that the reactors had melted down. These are considered highly sensitive matters in Japan, and they have a State Secrets Act where, if I were Japanese, I could potentially spend 10 years in prison for some of the material in this book. So, you know, it's a delicate question as to whether or not the book can, in fact, be translated into Japanese and appear in its current form.
We'll have to keep up with you on that to find out the future, because I have many listeners who are from Japan, who are in Japan, and I know that they would be very interested in having access to a book that explains their own situation with this much depth, clarity, and efficiency in the telling of the story. Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to get to now?
General feeling, this is not a happy subject. You're putting your finger on disaster, mayhem, propaganda, chaos, all sorts of subjects that maybe the listening public would rather not hear or think about. But you've been carrying on this good work for a long time. And, you know, I always think about these things. I consult the Daily News to figure out if there are any borders that I need to cross sooner rather than later. You always want to keep one or two passports at hand. And when it comes to nuclear disasters, I think we should keep our eyes and ears open, and we should try to figure out what to do in advance.
Thomas Bass, you've written a cornerstone book, I think, for those of us who deal with nuclear issues, Return to Fukushima. And I look forward to hearing further from you as to how it is going, how you are doing, what you're working on next. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Author Thomas Bass. His latest book, Return to Fukushima, was just published last week. And we'll link to a few sources where you can purchase it if you go to nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 727, because that's where you'll find those links.
Activists, shout out.
The 14th International Uranium Film Festival has concluded down in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The winners include U.S. director Greg Mitchell, who won the award for Best Documentary Feature Film for The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero and Nuclear Peril Today. It is a revelation of Nagasaki's place in history, and you can learn all about it by listening to last week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 726, where we interviewed Greg Mitchell on his remarkable film. And U.S. directors Judy Irving and Christopher Beaver received the award for Nagasaki Journey, Digitally Restored Version, the festival's memory award for the restoration of a powerful historical documentary film that connects today's young generation with the suffering of the young atomic bomb victims of Nagasaki. The screening of this digitally restored version in Rio de Janeiro was a world premiere for the International Uranium Film Festival. We'll have a list of all the many winners through a link on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 727. And for a really good time, if you can get up to Humboldt County on Saturday, June 14, Veterans for Peace is celebrating 10 years since the historic relaunch of the Golden Rule Peace Boat, and they're going to be holding a 10-year Splashiversity celebration from 2 till 4 p.m. at the Zerlang and Zerlang Boatyard in Humboldt Bay. You can enjoy an afternoon of inspiring speeches, live music, a ceremonial splash-in, sounds like you're going to need your bathing suits for that, and a chance to meet the crew, the project team, and the peace community. This is a free, family-friendly event celebrating the grassroots spirit that keeps the Golden Rule sailing strong for a nuclear-free world. We'll have a link for more information up on the website. And we'll also have a link up to an article by Ed Lyman, Director of Nuclear Power Safety for the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's called The Terrible 13, The Worst Safety and Security Violators in the U.S. Nuclear Power Fleet. Fascinating, if terrifying, reading. We'll have that link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 727. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 3rd, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we bring it to you special delivery. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or, better for us, go to nuclearhotseat.com, fill in the yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get just one email from us, but it will contain great riches, the link to that week's show, and a short description of its content. That way, you never need miss a single episode. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially in light of our upcoming start of our 15th year, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate all the support you can give. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.